Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 159. This week on the show, we talk cheese, frieze and black and white keys.
We'll be joined in the studio by restaurateur and general bon vivant Silvio Asini to talk to us about his true passion in life, mozzarella cheese.
We'll also get up close and personal one of the most iconic and unpredictable entertainers to take on the pianoforte since Liberace and Jerry Lee Lewis. That's right, we have Chili Gonzalez in the studio for a chat and some music.
Plus, we'll be checking in with Indian artist Sanath Banerjee about his recent work for the upcoming Frieze Festival and winning and losing at the Olympics.
That's all here on the Monocle Weekly, right here on Monocle 24. Episode 159, Jonathan Openshaw, you and me.
It's a benchmark.
It's a key number. It's a very boring. It's like having a top 11. It's my top four.
I know. I wish I'd been in the 150th.
159th, right?
Or maybe next week. That's more landmark. But no, it looks a good one. Cheese in the show. It can't be bad.
Cheese, frieze, and black and white keys. I like how the scripts become kind of a little bit like sounding like a sort of, I don't know, like a 1980s stand-up comedian's sort of warm-up act.
I got Bon Vivant.
I'm getting looked at through the glass for saying that.
I got Bon Vivant and restaurateur as well.
You got that, yeah.
It's all rhyming.
The black and white keys.
Keep the whole show going.
That's Chili Gonzalez. I understand you weren't here for that.
I missed it.
That was a very good
Where was I?
Gig.
I was away. I was on holiday. I was on holiday in the UK, which wasn't the best idea at this time of year, I'll be honest, because it pretty much rained the whole time. But it was in Whitstable, so we had lots of good food.
Lots of beer and oysters.
Oysters, yeah, and sometimes together, beer-battered oysters as well.
That's a good thing.
It is a new favourite that I hadn't actually had before, so that was nice.
I did
miss chili, which was a
pain. You did miss chili, but anyway, hey, you can listen to this thing. You can hear it. We're going to play it in.
Catch-ups.
I think that's something that, do you think sort of beer-battered oysters, the kind of thing that Danny Boyle is going to kind of try and incorporate in some way due to its exceptional Englishness, its Kentish Englishness, into the opening ceremony of the Olympics.
It's extraordinarily British, isn't it?
Isn't it?
I think if you deep fry anything, it just feels a little bit more UK.
Maybe we'll have sort of Kylie Minogue. That was good. Maybe we'll have Kylie Minogue sort of popping out of a battered oyster. Because we've taken her to our hearts.
It's so. A new take on Botticelli.
That's what I'd have. James Bond jumping out of a
Kylie emerging
fish and
from
chip.
A beer battered oyster.
Exactly. It sounds ruder than it actually is meant to sound, right? That.
I think we need to, a little bit. I think we need to be taken on as creative directors.
I think that's what we need. Right. Sanath Banerjee.
Yes.
He's coming up later in the show.
Not Banerjee. Oh, did you? Okay, yeah.
I went on a bus ride, courtesy of Frieze, and went around and sort of wandered around the strange kind of edge lands of the Olympic project and saw some of his art and some of his sort of fellow Frieze commissionees.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to chat to as well later on.
So Frieze are kind of curating the streets around the Olympics then?
Frieze, named after this summer, they've kind of stepped in. It's funny how they've become sort of London's art brand, isn't it, as well?
Completely.
Boom. Yeah. It's Frieze. It's got the stamp on it, the seal of approval.
I saw, actually, because we got the Mediterranean newspapers in yesterday.
And they smell good, don't they, as well?
Amazing. And Frieze have a nice double spread in there as well, so you know it's kind of building towards that time of year.
It is. It's always kind of getting, you know, when it's, you know, it's getting chilly and Frieze is just around the corner. They'll probably edit this bit out, won't they?
Probably. Our first guest on the show today is Silvio Asini. Born in Naples, the heartland of highly prized artisanal produced buffalo mozzarella, Silvio was immersed in the world of authentic Italian food from the get-go.
From these beginnings, Silvio embarked on a career in international business and luxury goods that taught him how beautiful and creative Italian products so often achieve international acclaim and success.
He's been at Bulgari since 1989, where he's now leading the field as creative director, but his passion project of bringing the highest quality, authentic mozzarella di bufala to the people has resulted in the opening of a global collection of restaurants called Obica in cities including New York, LA, Tokyo, and now London. Silvio, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So, interesting trajectory that you've taken. I mean, I guess you're born in Naples. You've then had this kind of career in the really high-end world of luxury. And now you're back to maybe the more earthy things of foods and where you're born. Is this, do you see it as a kind of full circle? What's the journey you've been on?
Oh, not really. In a way, mozzarella di bufala, it's a luxury product. It's a premium product. But also, I see a very strong parallel in what you know, I've been experiencing in luxury and at Bulgari. And what I'm trying to do with Obica Mozzarella Bar here, you know, I believe there is this thing about Italian design and Italian things that is torn between the really avant-garde brands and then the nostalgic old things that everybody kind of dreams about. And instead, both at Bulgari and now with OBK, what we're trying to do is present very traditional things in a contemporary way. So, you know, when I was traveling the world, I saw that everybody liked Italian food, but that there was really no fresh contemporary Italian food concept anywhere to be found. And that's where I got the inspiration to start one.
And I want to ask you about that. We talked about it in the queue as a passion project.
Yeah.
It's nice that you've been sort of practicing on Bulgari to come up with the mozzarella brand.
Absolutely.
So the cheese got the best years of your life, Silvio.
Yes.
And in what sense is it a luxury brand? I mean, we know that there are sort of different grades of mozzarella, but for our British listeners, it's possibly for everyone other than our Italian listeners, you'd have to guide us through quickly what's so special about the really good stuff.
Well, you know, the fact is that mozzarella started off as a really premium and special cheese, first of all, because it's the real one is made out of water buffalo milk, the mozzarella di bufala. And these are pretty wild animals, hard to tame, hard to milk. And this is why the cheese is also expensive, handcrafted, and so on.
This is why mozzarella farmers have lots of bruises.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Try milking one, you know.
I'll leave it to the experts, I think.
Yes, they. But over time, the name mozzarella has not been adequately protected, and therefore it has been associated with any kind of white, cheap stuff that you can find anywhere and grind over a pizza. So what we propose in our restaurants, what we are trying to defend is the tradition of handmade, hand-lopped mozzarella, fresh from the farm. These farms have their own herds of buffaloes. They're mostly grass-fed. They're not stabled all the year. So it's, you know, when we go down and ask them to go back and do the hand-lopped one, they look at us as if we are a bit crazy. But then after a while, the old craftsmen come out and teach the new ones, and it's very good, actually.
You mentioned there that the kind of brand that is mozzarella has been devalued, and I can imagine it must pain you somewhat to go into a supermarket today and you see these kind of vacuum-packed bags of grated, well, and probably closer to cheddar than mozzarella, but anyway, I mean...
So yes, it hurts.
How do you go about really kind of refocusing on what makes this such an exceptional ingredient? What are the kind of producers you're working with? What are the processes that you're trying to bring back?
Well, two things. First of all, the product itself. We make sure, as I said, that the farms are, you know, small, the real original farms with their own water buffaloes, that the quality is perfect. The milk is mostly raw milk or slightly pasteurized, so it maintains the whole flavor. And then the product is handmade and shipped fresh. So the product is there, and it's the best that you can find. But I think that perhaps most importantly is the way we present it. We showcase the mozzarella not as just another ingredient, but it's the heart of the offer of our restaurants. We have this mozzarella bar, which is like a sushi bar in the way it's presented, with these glass tanks that are really visible and are really the
heart. It's like choosing your lobster in a Chinese restaurant.
Exactly. It's
but
right there.
So, first thing you don't see, feel so guilty when you pluck it out.
Exactly. Doesn't scream.
I don't feel guilty anyway. Exactly.
So, you know, you walk in and you have this beautiful cheese, beautifully lit, and our staff fishes the mozzarellas out of the tanks and puts them in the dish with whatever accompaniment you may choose. So there is a whole also ritual about the serving and the presentation, and that's the novelty, I would say.
And there's no shortcuts here, are there? I mean, you've just opened, I believe, in South Kensington, London, and you're shipping mozzarella over, is it 3 times a week?
Yes, yes.
From Italy. So, I mean, obviously, that's a big investment. In some ways, that must change your business model quite a lot. But is it? It's really that integral?
Absolutely. It's worth it. Okay. Also, because it becomes, for everybody in our team, really, it's almost like a religion. You know, if the mozzarella is this good, everything has to be this good.
Yeah, I suppose if that's the sort of the key ingredient, everything else needs to live up to it.
Absolutely.
Let's have some. Well, also, we should describe. You brought in Silvio a tray. It's sitting on. I think these are basil leaves, but I can't smell them from here.
Spinach.
Oh, that's spinach.
Yeah.
This is a plat of mozzarella. I've not seen this. I'm used to seeing a big ball of the stuff wherever I am in the world. So tell me about this. This is a sort of. about 12 inches long. It's big. It looks like the most dangerous bit of mozzarella I've ever seen. So what is this, a traditional way of sort of serving it or displaying it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is what we call a treccia. Mm-hmm. It's about a kilo and a half. Treccia means braid. And it's actually, it starts off as a long tube of fresh mozzarella, handmade, which then two master cheesemakers braid, knot, and then close off. Basically, the reason why, and why this is better than the average big bowl, is that because it has more skin.
Okay, so and what does that do? That seals the good stuff in?
Well, the skin, it's the most tasty part.
Okay.
Rather than the inside.
It's the slightly more salty.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And it's the texture as well. Juicy. It's a slightly harder texture. It's the bit that kind of flakes.
Exactly. So you have to separate the skin from the interior if the mozzarella is good. If it's one thing, then it's what we call the tennis ball. It's bad.
Okay. Well, let's tuck in. Should we get some plates?
Please.
And we'll get some sort of... I wonder what sort of sound effect cutting of mozzarella achieves. Probably not much of one.
No, I would say that the sound perhaps is not one of the senses that that is awakened by mozzarella. But I like to compare, perhaps because of my previous background, the tasting of mozzarella to a diamond. You know, the four C's in a diamond: color, cut, clarity, and carats.
You can take the man out of bulgari.
Exactly. Okay. Well, the mozzarella is the same. It's the same thing. You know, you start from the color, which has to be porcelain white, shiny white, and then you have the texture. You know, here I'm cutting through the mozzarella. It's sort of gummy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't just go through like
so
a soft
cheese. It's just hard enough. I'm trying to see how hard that is by how white your knuckle gets as you cut it. And it looks like a tough outside and a soft inside.
And then when you open, you see what we were talking about before, the skin being different than the inside. And then as you squeeze it, you see all the little milk oozing out of the holes. And so that's the second thing that you do. And then you have obviously the flavor in your mouth. Have a taste, please.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And there's different
and
types
the
of...
chewiness also. I think it's the consistency is very, very important. It has to be slightly gummy, slightly chewy to be perfect.
And there's different types as well, isn't there? There's the kind of natural, and then there's the smoked, and then there's... What kind of are the main...
Well, we offer here in London three types. The classic, which is the white one that you have in front of you. Then the smoked, which is actually one of my favorites because it's naturally smoked. Let me just spend a couple of words about that because it's one of the things I'm proudest of. It's naturally smoke a mozzarella. They put it in a big barrel full of hay. They fire up the hay, put the mozzarella on top, close the lid, and the mozzarella gets naturally smoked by this hay. Smoke. And this is very unique because I'm afraid to say that any other smoked cheese you find on the shelves is artificially smoked.
Mm. They also do things with the rind and things rather than the actual cheese itself inside the rind, don't they? With smoke, a lot of smoked cheeses.
Possibly, but worse
but
yet,
also flavorings.
So that's why if you don't peel your average smoked stuff, you will have a problem later. You will feel it later. In ours,
just like I saw, he is clutching his belly there in the most un-Obikurish way.
Right.
I hope.
So the third kind we offer is the burrata, which you have right there.
Yeah.
And the burrata is a type of mozzarella that comes from Puglia.
No, this one here.
The one in the jar.
Okay.
Which
so it's kind of more liquid almost.
Absolutely, because it's actually a pouch of mozzarella filled with cream, fresh cream, and mozzarella shreds.
Okay.
And then you're supposed to open the pouch and cut it all up, shred it all up. And it's become hugely popular lately because it's very indulgent. Let's put it that way.
Mm. Sylvia, so we're enjoying the burrata. We're just about to. We've had the plat of mozzarella as well, and you've talked through the consistency of stuff. What are a couple of the key things? When you say that Obico is a mozzarella bar, what are the sort of couple of the key things? One of the most popular things you found, and you've only just launched, but that you found, what are the things you're trying to promote, I wonder, that mozzarella is key to?
Well, I think that, you know, of course, customers go for the most familiar things. For example, mozzarella with tomatoes or mozzarella with prosciutto. But what I like to do is have the customer experiment a bit with different accompaniments. For example, we offer the mozzarella paired with this very unique mortadella.
Mm-hmm.
Mortadella can be very cheap. Again, it's one of those things that's been a bit abused. But we have found this small producer in Prato, near Florence, that does this handmade mortadella, which is a slow food protected product, by the way, which is hand-cut, soaked in a liqueur, and then wrapped, and it's the most amazing mortadella you can find. And the pairing of this sort of a meaty flavored taste with the sweetness of the mozzarella is just unbelievable.
So it's quite a lot of, I hate to use the word fusion, so I won't use it, the F word.
No.
That's what they call
no,
it.
No, don't do
it. But you're doing burrata, which is a sort of, which is mixing things up. You're smoking some of your mozzarella and you're using it with mortadella and you're soaking the mortadella in liqueur. So there is a sense of you're doing something extra to this stuff. There's obviously something about the purity of the basic ingredient, but you're sexing it up a bit.
Absolutely, but sticking to very traditional things. Mm. We're not into, you know, mozzarella and mango or mozzarella and
you should have seen the face
whatever.
He made when I said fusion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I think the whole idea, which is very simple, is to take really traditional products, actually go and find products that are about to disappear or that are very, very rare, but present them in a very contemporary way. So the design of the place, the decoration, the style, the attitude, the serving ceremony are truly contemporary. Nothing nostalgic, no checkered tablecloth, no garlic bandanas, you know.
So what was
no, God, so you're telling me there's not a kind of wicker basket for the wine to go in?
Absolutely not.
Oh, no.
Absolutely not.
Well, all right.
We're guys serenading you as you eat. But so what was the design of the place? You were trying to keep it very fresh and simple. What, were you looking, kind of, maybe you're looking more East?
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally Japanese. I mean, I got the inspiration to do this mozzarella bar thing, which is a new word, if you want, in Japan about 25 years ago when I saw my first sushi bar. And I was just awed by the reverence that these people have for their food and their fish and the mastery that they have. And I said, you know, maybe we can do something like this with our beautiful Italian products. And that's what we did.
Have we got any other types of mozzarella on the table here? Have we mixed anything up?
No, I think we have the smoked, the plain, and the burrata. We have a few accompaniments which actually are quite interesting. One is our basil pesto, which is remarkable because it's freshly made every day, but above all, is garlic-free. We have a religion about no garlic, no onion in the restaurant anywhere. And the people
and again,
are
you smell the cheese
just mixed
anymore
together.
As well,
can you smell that?
Yeah, you smell the cheese comes
you
through much
the
stronger.
Cheese, you smell the basil, but no garlic whatsoever.
In the whole restaurant?
Anywhere.
Because just because it's so overpowering.
It is. It's a quick excuse. I mean, I use judiciously garlic at home when I cook for my friends, but in a restaurant, it's an easy excuse. You know, you eat a garlic bruschetta and your taste buds are gone and forget the mozzarella. I mean, forget it.
That's an interesting thing. So that's you've taken that off the menu. You've taken that out of the chef's hands in order that you can taste the sort of key ingredient properly.
Exactly.
That's a gutsy decision, isn't it?
It is.
People probably go, well, you know, come on, it's an Italian restaurant. I need to have these flavors.
People are somehow startled, but then they truly appreciate it. I mean, all the feedback that I've been getting from customers is truly amazing. They love it. It becomes fresh all of a sudden.
This I think Silvio is almost weeping as he tells us this. Look at him; he's almost wetting up about the mozzarella.
Well,
I don't blame him. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But thank you for telling us and bringing in this lovely lot of stuff, and for telling us about Orbica. Where are you? You're on Draycott Avenue.
We are on Draycott Avenue 96. Yes.
And that's a very French area. What's going to happen? Is there turf war?
Well, to be honest with you, there is a few French restaurants, but there is a vast Italian, very nice population there.
Good.
And so they've found their home with us.
Home from home at Orbica.
Exactly.
Silvio Orsini, thank you so much for coming
and
telling Jonathan and I about this beautiful stuff. Next up, tinkling the ivories, will be Chilly Gonzalez. And you're back with the Monocle Weekly. Did you have enough cheese?
I am. I feel a lot like that mozzarella looks, which is white and bloated. But
very nice.
It was delicious. I'm not always a cheese fan. I used to actually not be able to eat it very much, but I made an exception for this.
I've seen you putting it away.
Yeah,
put the light.
I feel like I've eaten. What do you say that was? A pound of cheese.
It's a lot of cheese.
It looks like a good baby size of cheese, and I've eaten half of that.
And also I quite like that thing where people go, I'm all into this, and you go, oh, really? And then they display lots of different types, and they say, taste this, and I'll taste this, and I'll taste this. And then you go, oh, I see now why it's like the same price as gold, and heavier.
It's also always lovely when you get guests onto these shows and they're genuinely passionate, quite movingly passionate about what they do. And it's you wouldn't think that you could almost be moved to tears about cheese, but I think Sylvia's getting pretty close.
You could be moved to tears by it. Depends what your dreams are like, right? after you've eaten enough of it, after you've eaten a surfeit of it.
Yeah.
How are we going to get to Chili Gonzales from this?
Cheese and chili goes together. There's vague alliteration going on.
I like it. Okay. You've got to do it, though. You've got to make the jump.
Chili Gonzales. Right, so I've got some background about the guy. So since 1999, Jason Charles Beck, better known as electro rap prankster, classically trained pianist, and Grammy-nominated producer Chili Gonzales, has been refusing to be put in anyone's box. And those constantly itchy musical feet have travelled well, bringing collaborations with Daft Punk, Drake, and Feist to pop's high table.
Gonzo, as he's also known, stopped by Monocle 24 Studios earlier this week to play a very special session Campiano Greatness 101 class to a rapt crowd. And then we did manage to get him in a box, just briefly, as he joined me for a chat in Studio 2. First off, though, here he is in front of the Midori House crowd playing a track which answered a puzzle he set himself. How can you make a melancholy and emotional track using the white keys on a piano only? So this is White Keys. Chili, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. And before we're going to hear you play in a minute. And there are all sorts of facets. We're going to hear some solo piano, 2, which is the new record.
That's right.
This is a very pure thing, isn't it? Does it come from a very sort of pure place? It's got a very clean sound.
Well, the sound itself isn't actually clean at all. If you compare it to how piano records are made in the classical and jazz world these days, it's very ping, 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 very antiseptic. So actually, we sort of do more of a room recording, more like they recorded back in the 40s and 50s. But that's neither here nor there. If we're talking about purity, I would say that, yes, the idea that, you know, these are live takes of something that happened in that room on an upright piano, the kind of piano you could imagine, you know, in your hallway growing up.
Uh-huh. I think about a pub knees up. This is, well, that's dirty upright piano. This sounds more like pure.
Well, it sounds more like what we associate with musical intimacy, I think. Uh-huh. You know, a grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point, in a way. So, like today at the session here at the Monocle session, I'm going to be doing my show on an upright piano as well, because I'm going to be trying to recreate some of the intimacy of the album. So all of that contributes to what I would call sort of a close-up. You know, if Chilly Gonzalez is a movie, doing sometimes orchestral rap and popping up in strange places like the iPad commercial and on a Daft Punk album, mm-hmm. all of that is only possible because of the piano. You know, when Daft Punk calls me to play on their album, it's to play the piano. It's not to rap. It's not to be conceptual. Uh-huh. It's not to make them laugh. I'm there for a pretty specific reason. It's what I can do on the piano. And so I consider it a close-up amongst the more wilder scenes in the Chilly Gonzalez movie that's been sort of ongoing now for about 12 years.
All right, well, tell me about the Chilly Gonzalez movie that's been going on. I mean, it's an exciting movie. It's sort of a bit of a thriller. It's a bit of an action movie. There's all sorts of things.
Well, for those who
chucked
know,
into that
that's
soup.
That's right. For
right,
those who know, but you know, I put a lot of effort into the sort of backstory, mm-hmm. and I put a lot of effort into making sure that when I release an album, I try to explain more than just where the music came from, but where the entire message comes from. And when I say message, it's because, you know, I consider myself an entertainer. So I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
This idea of the entertainer is an interesting one. And the idea of filling in the blanks, because a lot of musicians aren't particularly great at talking about their work or their facade that they perhaps present. A lot of people kind of go, well, the music does the talking, man. But you're different to that. There's a kind of idea of, there's a definite theatricality to it. Solo Piano Number 2, the new record, does that strip away that theatricality, or is that part of the entertainer? Is this part of the persona, this intimate side of you?
Well, the theatrical side is the most literal link with what people think of as entertainment. You know, I think Daft Punk are great entertainers. Uh-huh. They've never opened their mouths for an interview in their lives. I mean, they don't even show their faces, but they found something really poetic with those robot masks and their iconography. And so it touches you, you know? It's a very different take than I do. I have a more big mouthed entertainer comedian side, but of course I also think the purity we were talking about of Solo Piano 1 and 2, mm-hmm. That's part of entertainment too, because I'm really thinking of my audience. I'm literally picturing them, the ones I see on my 100 shows a year. I'm literally want to really get something through to them. So I do consider intimacy, extreme intimacy, a huge part of entertainment as well. Yes, to sort of look at me, that part of me, that's a more literal way. That's a way to get attention. But once you have people's attention, you have to show different sides, of course. I don't think it would have lasted this long if I'd only been the look at me guy. And so I've been careful to always make sure the backstory is like you get to know a person. You know, sometimes you get to know a really gregarious, slightly socially dominant entertainer. You'll meet a guy like that, and you might like him, and then you might start to hate him a little bit. He might transgress, and then in a certain moment, he'll reveal maybe why he's like that, and you'll start to understand more about him. I think if you become a fan of Chilly Gonzalez, you're going to go through something like that.
This movie has more sequels than Police Academy, it sounds. Come on. We can both do that. Something like The Unspeakable Chilly Gonzalez, the record that came before, that was a far different kettle of fish. Do they come from sort of different sides of the brain? When you sit down in the studio, you sit down at home to write an album like that, how does it work? Do you feel like you're sort of channeling a different version of Chilly Gonzalez for two such different sounding records?
It's more to do with what I'm going through at the time. When I was writing The Unspeakable Chilly Gonzalez, it was a very, very fast-moving lifestyle at that point. And I want to represent that because I had ideas that I want to express. I think ideas are great to express in rap. Rap isn't really about expressing emotions. It's really about representing, you know, it's closer to talking than singing, isn't it? So that means it's more like how people talk, which means full of boasting, full of power games, full of very, very complex indirect projections, let's say. That's what conversation is between human beings, you know, and rap kind of represents that. So what I was going through, I wanted to express ideas. But when it comes to emotions, I don't think words can do it. That's why I don't really believe in singing as much as some people do. I think, you know, this is a kind of German idea. When the Italians invented opera, the idea was that by putting music to words, you can express the unspoken emotions. And that's why the opera singer goes off to the side and says the thing that they couldn't tell the rest of the world.
In opera aren't very good,
exactly.
Are they?
Then the Germans came along, Beethoven and such, and they said, no. If you really want to express emotions, it has to be pure music. Words cannot even be there at all. And so I think when it comes to expressing emotions, it's more of a German idea. Solo Piano 2 is more of an emotional statement than an intellectual one. You know, both albums are intimate because The Unspeakable, I'm getting very, very personal as well. But it is more about intellectual ideas and projections than Solo Piano 2, which are real, more emotional revelations.
So we're getting a look into your heart and soul with Solo Piano 2, whether we're getting a look
if,
into
if you must the inner reduce it to that, that if brain. You must reduce it to that, then perhaps, yes.
That's hardly reducing it to anything. An inner a look into your soul. Come on, that's not...
But we just said that words can't express this kind of thing. So, right. You know, if you'd played it on a piano, perhaps, then I would agree.
Tell us about collaborations. Drake, Feist, you mentioned Daft Punk. You've got a big personality, and the entertainer side of you is obviously... It's a big thing. It's your musical persona. How easy is it to collaborate with people when you bring sort of so much to the table?
Well, I collaborate with other great entertainers. Right. Feist, in her own way, despite being coming from the indie rock world, obviously, we saw her 1, 2, 3, 4 video. She's a great showman, showwoman in her own way. And Drake, needless to say, a rapper, therefore entertainer by definition. Daft Punk, huge heroes of mine. All of that, it comes, like I said, because they want me to play the piano. All of them understand the difference between what you project onto the stage and real life. So there's no problem. Drake isn't doing cliche rapper things while we're in the studio. Feist isn't, you know, doing cliche indie rocker things while we're in the studio, and Daft Punk aren't doing cliche DJ things while we're in the studio. You know, no one is that cliche. Everyone is there to work. We all know why I'm there. I'm there for the piano and not to bounce off the walls and be Chili Gonzalez in my bathrobe.
Well, it's a great shame, I think. We want to see some hidden camera footage.
I understand that people imagine that, but if you could just see how focused and hardworking I am in the studio, you would perhaps think of me as the old-fashioned conservative musician that I truly am.
And I like that idea. You said if people could see you hard at work in the studio. What are your studio hours? How do you work? Are you a late night merchant or are you a office hours merchant?
Well, I'm more of a performer than a studio guy. I try to minimize time in the studio. I don't like it fundamentally. So it's great to be a piano player. You go in, you do your take, and you get out. I used to produce albums for months at a time. I did not like it. I did not like the repetitious nature of it.
So you're a kind of one take wonder, and you feel that there's a purity in that. Get it in nailing it.
Well, exactly. And there's people there. You know, when I went to play piano on the La Rue record recently, you know, I do these performances. And who's my audience in that case? Well, it's La Rue. I really like their music. And we don't know each other very well. I essentially want to impress and please them. You know, that's my entertainer's nature. So I go in and I'm looking at them through the glass and I'm trying to have that moment where I'm communicating something. I mean, that's the only way it works for me. To just sit there and make music in a vacuum, in my case, it really doesn't work. And that's why I've always said, well, I'm not a true artist. I'm an entertainer. I'm linked to the reaction of the audience forever, and therefore will always be somehow a musical capitalist, you might say, because I believe that, you know, the audience is always right. And that really places me at odds with many people who either truly or falsely believe that there's something such as that there's value in so-called authenticity. You know, I've never seen that. Authenticity is about preserving yourself and keeping it pure before it reaches the audience. I think you make something pure, but then, of course, it inherently gets corrupted by the transition from entertainer to audience. And that's what's beautiful about it, you know? The fact that something gets lost is why we keep coming back. If it was that easy to express yourself, wouldn't everyone be a great artist? Isn't it the hardest thing to actually communicate? So, I don't know, it's pretty simple to me. If you say you're an artist, it probably means you're... it probably means you're interested in the lifestyle and the cachet that comes with that word artist, you know, and that word has always put me off because I thought, well, I've met a few true artists, but they were people who legitimately didn't care about an audience. They were more obsessive, compulsive artists. You know, I met some in Berlin. I met some in my academic travails in Montreal when I was studying music. Those people I respect, you know. But anyone who says they're an artist but secretly wishes they had an audience, well, that means that they're actually just a failed entertainer.
It means they're a blogger.
Moment. Yeah. in that moment, you should say, okay, you know what? I do want the audience to like me, but that's hard because you're setting yourself up for rejection, which I do time and time again. But they'll realize that once you actually start to build a real audience and have an intimate relationship with them, that's when you're winning.
There's that famous portrait of Chatterton in the National Gallery, who's pale, red-haired, and he's lying, and he was 19 when he died, and he wanted to be he wanted to imbue the spirit of Byron, and he died in Paris in some sort of far-flung arrondissement when he was 19, and he's like the ultimate sort of romantic icon for lots of people, that picture is. But you feel that artists more are people that almost can't help being artists, they can't help producing stuff, they don't care what they're called.
A true artist, yeah, is probably someone who wouldn't pose for a picture. That's what I'm saying. A true artist doesn't sign a record deal. A true artist doesn't take photos. A true artist doesn't come on radio and talk about his work in a sense, because then you're communicating. Then somehow, how can you say you don't care? How can you say, I do it for myself, and if people like it, it's a bonus? Isn't that just hypocritical? Shouldn't those people quit? The answer is yes.
Well, Chilly Gonzalez, the legend and the artist, but more so the entertainer. Thank you so much for joining us on the weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chilly Gonzalez is a lively interviewee, as you heard there.
And fantastic music. Amazing.
Yeah, he was...
What was it? So it was Monday morning, set the scene. What was...
It was Monday morning. Everyone was a bit like, oh, all right then. And then, of course, he did this incendiary performance and was amazing. And of course, and I hope it comes across in the music we played just then. But he's a sort of consummate performer. He took the front off the piano, so you could see everything.
Well, we had a piano, firstly. Yeah, which I think it's a monocle first that we've kind of...
And he's interesting as well, because he didn't want a grand piano. He wanted an upright piano because he feels that grand pianos are too much like a sort of dick extension or something. You know, he feels they're not democratic, and he feels that they're all about, you know. So there was this thing. I think he mentioned that in the interview as well. And he was, but he was a cool guy and very giving. But he's also got this kind of like, I'm an entertainer. Mm. I'm going to entertain you. It might not be any lyrics to this song I've written, but it doesn't matter. I'm still going to kind of get you into it. People kind of left like stunned. And
I was about to say that when I got back on Tuesday morning, there was still a sense of slight kind of Chilly Gonzalez awe in the office.
There was still some reverb bouncing off the walls, I think.
People talking about it. Those are.
Put the sustain pedal called? On a bit
water,
too long.
Water cooler moments. lots of water cooler moments.
Water cooler moments.
I know. I was getting.
It's taken 159 episodes of the Monocle Weekly, ladies and gentlemen. And finally, you've heard water cooler moments. Courtesy of Jonathan Openshaw. Thank you very much. This edition of the Monocle Weekly was brought to you by Water Cooler Moments. Next up, we're going to go to East London to a man commissioned by the Frieze Project. His name is Sarnath Banerjee. Here in London, Olympics fever is reaching a zenith, and everywhere one looks, there are a plethora of purple-hued signs, posters, ads, warnings, and Olympic-branded ephemera, as well as a few more thoughtful selections from our next guest.
Well, Sarnath Banerjee is often touted as India's most famous graphic novelist and was one of just five artists invited by the Frieze Foundation to show public artworks in London during the Olympics this summer. The 48 billboards, already on show in parts of East London, will focus on the seldom-discussed character of Olympic lore, the loser. Sarnath, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why, were you given this fantastic platform by Frieze, why have you chosen to hone in on the loser rather than the winner?
Well, you know, it kind of brings in a certain humanism to something as brutal as the Olympics, because there is always something more complicated and multidimensional when you lose rather than winning. I mean, sometimes I even find sort of winning somewhat vulgar, and I find losing deeply beautiful sometimes, and I just want to bring that out a little bit.
And Sarnath, I've been on a bus tour of some of the Frieze projects in East London. I went this week, and it was great. And it was nice to see I'm familiar with your work in graphic novel form, but it's amazing to see it on these big billboards around the city. Is it sort of strange? Do you have to sort of double take them yourselves when you sort of aided the erection of these posters around the east of the city?
Well, that's very interesting. Because, I mean, see, I use the form of graphic novel. See, graphic novel is a language which I speak. So it doesn't have to restrict itself to the conventions of graphic novel. It doesn't have to be in a book, for example. I work with text and image. And I seem to express things much better using text and image, either or a situation or an event or something. I seem to sort of say it much better using text and image, which is why the graphic novel format seems to be very attractive. When I see it large, when I see the image interacting with the community, when I see certain images being vandalized, for example, after the football match, one image has been sort of, you know, ripped, the goalkeeper image. I feel that somehow the images sort of gain its own sort of life, you know, while being within the community, and sort of you see the community sort of interact with it, either with love or with indifference or with anger, and that kind of, you know, that adds and brings life into those sort of images and takes them out of the book. If that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarnath, unlike Rob, I haven't unfortunately been off on a jolly with Frieze, so I haven't seen the work firsthand. Can you describe a little bit to us what this set of pieces looks like, what it's about?
Well, you know, I started out creating what you might call sort of a gallery, if you may say, an emporium of losers. So what I did was I tried to kind of, you know, put together people. So it's like, for example, I have a boxer who is absolutely, I mean, rather than thinking about like actually winning from the sort of the first bell till the end, he's thinking about dodging punches. I have a pole vaulter who, in the middle of a jump, suddenly thinks that perhaps, just perhaps, he might have chosen the wrong spot. And you can sort of, you know, from the corner of your eyes, you can see two Roman rings sort of hanging from the bar. I have sort of a high jumper who constantly thinks about sort of levitation. He eats light food, reads sort of light literature, sort of, you know, lives in a certain kind of miasma of lightness, but feels heavy in the evenings because he's only won a single bronze medal in his entire career. So he can't avoid the weight. A javelin thrower who accidentally hits a long jumper, thus disqualifying himself and destroying the medal chances of the later. A ping pong player who suddenly is aware of the eerie silence of the indoor stadium and tries to remember how one spells eerie. So, you know, there are all these, you know, a judo champion who learned the sport through mail order correspondent courses. So I have all these losers you can think of. I mean, you don't have to go far.
They're sort of losers, Sanath, aren't they? But they're sort of near winners. They're people that kind of just failed to get a bronze medal. So there's a sort of strange artistic poignancy about their near miss, if you like. Is that something you wanted to sort of focus on? I wondered also in the sort of prism of India, which we're always told is such a vibrant, go-getting, business-like nation. Is this a sort of story of India in microcosm of how you see it as well?
Well, I mean, I thought to counterpoint the other Indian work, which celebrates the power and the sort of, you know, the sort of forthright, powerful. I don't want to use the word self-congratulatory, but certainly a sort of a very confident side of India, which is sort of seen in terms of scale and size and big corporations, you know, people who buy up companies and all that kind of thing. I mean, that's not the India I grew up with. You know, I'm firmly a third world India. Who sort of, you know, stood in long queues to kind of get a visa to enter different countries. So I what that gave us was a great sense of humor. I mean, you know, we had humor as a bit of a weapon. So that kind of, you know, so I want to sort of underline the fact that there is only a small percentage of Indians who are sort of suddenly become this sort of, you know, fairly arrogant side of India, you know, there's sort of, I mean, China as well, there's a small side of China and India which is arrogant, but most of India is still kind of, you know, fairly modest. Number two is, I just thought that, you know, this sort of self-congratulation needed to be sort of questioned, and I just had to do this because it's not unempowering if you start talking about your weaknesses. You know, it's precisely the same vulnerability which makes you do good work. The moment you sort of, you know, become very powerful as an artist, you sort of start losing it. It's almost like being a fire walker. When if you like stop being nervous walking on fire, you'll burn yourself.
We want this to be in the Olympics, Sanat. We want fire walking to be there. But this is an Indian gold medal waiting to happen.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, beyond all that, you know, this sort of conversation, this sort of, you know, me wanting, like, you know, making a gallery of, like, sort of losers, I am completely rooting for the Manipuri girls who are sort of, you know, our boxing chances, you know, if one of them wins. I mean, suddenly these are, like, you know, very few occasions you feel like you belong to a country. You feel that sort of, you know, some kind of nationalism. And I think, not nationalism, but a sense of nation, I suppose. And when these girls, Mary Kom and her gang from Manipur, like literally below the poverty line, you know, endeavoring to kind of win, there are big medal chances. And I really, really hope, despite my gallery of losers, to have one of my Manipuri sisters to kind of actually get a medal.
Well, obviously, it touches on a lot of things that are very close to you. But I'm interested in what was the process that you went into to kind of find these quite compelling stories? Is it a purely creative and imaginative leap for you, or did you kind of have to get into the psychology of the loser in some way to get these quite amusing but often quite kind of poignant images across?
Well, you know, I started off with sort of anecdotal, like, you know, journalistic reportage sort of a thing, which is quite fashionable in the world of graphic novels because you have all these sort of artists going to different cities and sort of writing their little diaries, and they become like sort of, you know, what you call that graphic journalism or whatnot. I was seduced by that form, and I started looking at Jürgen Hansen and, like, you know, obscure sort of people from the past, and, you know, Sebastian. Not Sebastian Coe, but Steve Cram, and, you know, like people like Nemesis. And then I just realized that it's just becoming extremely sort of anecdotal and reportage reportages, and it just sort of losing the entire sort of spirit of the project, which is basically to understand, to get into the skin of the loser, to kind of what propels the person to kind of go next day and jump, you know, and then sort of, you know, do high jump or whatever, you know, go to the dojo. So the only thing that's left to me was to actually become the sports person, theoretically. I mean, that doesn't mean that I was like going and like sort of going to the track and like just trying hurdles. It's just that I started like actually kind of started going to these sort of Berlin parties and pretending to be a shot putter. Or I mean, I don't look like a shot putter, but you know, just for like conversation's sake. I mean, for a week I would like sort of, you know, constantly read, think. Like when I was like behaving like a high jumper, all I did was sort of think about gravity. And that was a good way, I mean, kind of method acting almost, of sort of, you know, trying to get into the skin of the loser. And that helped somewhat, you know, personally also it helped.
Okay, Sana, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. And I should say to our listeners all over the world, if they're down around here, around Olympic time, to get in a taxi and have a wander, have a drive around East London to see some of these posters and your four other sort of co-commissioned artists for these freeze projects. Sanath Banerjee, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jonathan, these are decent, these things. I wonder what you think of sort of some of the other stuff that's been commissioned in the name of Olympic art. I'm thinking of this big...
We're thinking of the huge...
the kind of, what is this, like Alton Towers gone wrong?
I saw it described quite nicely as a resident saying it looked like a roller coaster that's crashed into the Spaghetti Junction.
Yeah.
But it's the Mitte orbit. I can see it from my bedroom window, actually.
Can you?
So I saw the whole process of it going up over the last few months.
Suddenly, boring, there it was.
Yeah, I mean... I don't know. I think it's a big and easy target for people to take a pot shot at. I think I've heard Kapoor talk very convincingly about what his thinking behind it was, and he wanted to bring back the kind of awe and spectacle that used to be involved in architecture that we've slightly lost, and to look at a building that kind of actually feels Escher-like, a construction that kind of boggles the mind slightly. So, I mean, nice. Our very young Adrian Craddock visited it and had a look on it, and apparently the viewing platform is actually quite amazing. They have these optical illusions which does kind of spin you out slightly. But yeah, at the same time, I mean, I can see the possible faults,
the folly, yeah. the grand folly. Yeah, I think the control tower is the only problem, isn't it? Because I think it would look like a sculpture, and it has to have a bit that you can stand on, which slightly.
And also
it.
Safety netting. Have you seen that? They have to have green safety netting all over it now as well.
Yeah. So we're going to leave it there for episode 159, Jonathan of the Monocle Weekly. That brilliant tongue tripping. Anniversary 159. It's the one everyone wants to be on. Today's show is produced by Paul Noble and Tom Hall. So thanks for tuning in. I think we'll be here same time, same place next week.
Usually pretty reliable.
Might be different staff, but we'll certainly be here. Thanks for tuning in.